Hi, and welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. Joe Gelonesi with you. Good to have you along. Today, the upside and the downside of superintelligence.
If it's the kind of machine which is smart enough to improve its performance by rewriting its own software, what's to stop it turning the whole world into IKEA furniture? There isn't yet any kind of coherent science of studying and managing these risks. And I think that as a species, we've reached a point in our development where we need to develop that science to protect ourselves from our own success.
Hugh Price on the revolt of the robots. And he's not the only one who says it could happen. We're seeing new centres opening up, dedicated to working out what the risks of superintelligence might be. And they're powered by some accomplished big thinkers. The Bertrand Russell Professor of Philosophy at Cambridge is one of them. Hugh Price is on the front foot, trying to raise awareness about a potentially serious future shock. Not everyone sees it in quite the same way, though. Could the risk be turned into an opportunity? A different view of the future a little later. But back to Hugh Price on his awakening. It all started innocently enough at a conference in Copenhagen.
And one of the people at the conference was a man called Jan Tarlin, who was one of the people who invented Skype. And I knew that because we had a session at the beginning of the conference where everyone had 2 minutes to introduce themselves. And then a few days later, I found myself in a cab in Copenhagen with Jan on our way to a conference dinner and trying to be sociable. I tried to think of something to talk about. So I asked him what he did for a living these days. I knew that since he'd had a share in Skype, he probably didn't need to do anything for a living if he didn't want to. He said, "What I'm really interested in is AI risk." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he started telling me about a bunch of ideas, which I'd loosely heard about the possible risks that we face when artificial intelligence gets to the point where, to put it crudely, it's smarter than we are and has the ability to make itself smarter still. And many people are worried, and Jan's very worried, that at that point there might be a kind of exponential runaway effect, so that the machines, having the ability to improve themselves, can rapidly get far smarter than we are. I knew about those ideas sort of in the abstract, had never thought about them, and had certainly never met anyone who cared about them deeply, and especially somebody with his feet on the ground in the computer world in the way that Jan obviously had. And he said that on his pessimistic days, he thought he had a higher chance of dying from some AI-related accident than of dying from heart disease or cancer. And Jan was at that stage in his late 30s, I think. So it gives you a sense of how the threat might be. I mean, he's since told me that I got him on a pessimistic day and it was Copenhagen and so on. But all the same, I was surprised by the fact that somebody who obviously knew so much about software and related things. And then as it happened, about 2 weeks later, I was passing through his hometown, Tallinn in Estonia, after giving some lectures in Helsinki on my way to Cambridge. And so I emailed him and suggested that we meet up for another chat. And so we had lunch. And one thing that was in my mind by that point was that one of the people I already knew in Cambridge was a fascinating man called Martin Rees, who and is Astronomer Royal, so one of the most distinguished scientists in Britain, whom I knew through philosophy of cosmology circles. One of the things I knew about him is that he too was interested in the catastrophic risks to humanity arising from human technology. And so the idea that had occurred to me was that there might be an interesting and useful role for me to play as a kind of catalyst between these two rather impressive people and their respective circles.
And is this what is meant by existential risk?
I think I got the term existential risk from a very interesting philosopher at Oxford University called Nick Bostrom. And it's a term that some people had been using just as a label for what you might loosely call extinction level risks, risks which are so serious that one of the possibilities they involve is that the human species might go extinct, or at least that civilization as we know it, sort of advanced technological civilization, might come to an end because of damage from one of these risks.
Going back to Tallinn's issue, and that is artificial intelligence, AI, we do hear a lot about it. And even as we've discovered and explored on this program, it has hit limits.
I suppose my reason for being sceptical about people who say, oh, this will never happen, or it's thousands of years off, is that we have, in one sense, we have a very good sense of the level of technology required for human-level intelligence, because we know it's all done with roughly a kilo of wet biological matter that each of us has within our skull. Now, there's a lot we don't understand about how the brain works, but it's really hard to believe that the sort of present rates of progress, we're not going to crack it sometime in this century.
And I guess your point, though, is that even if that's in reach next century, a century after, that there is a difference between what intelligence is and what intelligence can do.
Yeah, I think that's another very good point to make. One of the things that people who are trying to be optimistic here sometimes say is, but look, we don't understand what intelligence is. Why should we be worried about artificial intelligence, as we're taking over, if we don't even understand what intelligence is? And so I like to say to those people, well, don't think about what intelligence is. Think about what intelligence does. Think about what our intelligence enables us to do. It enables us, in important sense, to be the dominant species on this planet and to control our environment. So what we need to worry about, we don't need to worry in the abstract about something that's more intelligent than us, whatever that might mean. What we need to worry about is something that's more effective than we are about controlling the environment on this planet, and which has goals of its own.
Where do those goals come from, though, if it's just emulating behaviour?
Well, one of the possibilities that people like Jan, who worry about these things, talk about is the possibility that the danger might actually come from something which has extremely simple goals, which have been programmed into it by us. I like to use the example of an automated factory that's been set up to produce, say, IKEA furniture. Now, imagine that you have such a factory. It's been programmed to produce as much furniture as possible, as cheaply as possible. And it discovers that it can improve its performance on that primary goal if it removes those limitations and reprograms itself. If it's the kind of machine which is smart enough to improve its performance by rewriting its own software, what's to stop it, as it were, turning the whole world into IKEA furniture? The point is that you only need a very simple conception of a goal.
Because a simple goal is to create this sort of furniture.
Yeah. So all a goal is effectively something that tells the machine what point it's aiming for. So it's like a kind of end point in its decision tree. One of the problems at the moment is that we have a very limited sense as to what the range of possible scenarios actually is. I mean, we have a very limited sense of what the space of possible intelligences is like. We have a particular kind of intelligence which is a product of our biological heritage and our sort of social heritage. And there's a great danger of over-anthropomorphizing when we think about other possible intelligences. But I think we have very little conception of what the possibilities are. If this technology does get into this sort of exponential spiral where it can improve itself, we've got very little idea as to where that progression is going to head in the limit. Probably depends on, as it were, where it starts. And one of the research projects that people in this field have now is to think about the project as to whether it's possible to design what's called a friendly AI. That is, AI such that once this process gets going, there's some reason for believing that it's going to head in a direction which would be good from our point of view rather than bad from our point of view. Mm. So one of the striking features of our own situation, which it's easy to ignore because it's just there in the background, is that, first of all, that we have a particular kind of intelligence which, as I said before, has been sort of bestowed to us by biology and evolution and no doubt social evolution as well. But that level of intelligence, as well as being well above anything else presently on the planet, also has a particular kind of shape. So, you know, I sometimes use the metaphor of a mountain, and think of a mountain that you know has a particular shape. My favorite example here is Mount Fuji, because it has such a distinctive shape. The possibility that we have to face up to is that our technology might produce other mountains which are not only much higher than Mount Fuji, because the machines are much smarter and much faster, but also have a completely different shape. And when we were talking before about not having a sense of the space of possible intelligences, I mean, in terms of this metaphor, we've just got no idea what height or what shape these other mountains could be. And we've got really very little sense of what it would be like to be living on a planet where our Mount Fuji was just overshadowed by some hulking mountain range of some shape which we can't predict.
Mm. Essentially, all the things we've talked about seem to have gates, prohibitions, amendments, ways of acting in the future which will stop these things doing naughty things to us.
Yeah, one of the conceptual aspects of this whole project, where I think my skills as a philosopher of science do come into play, is in thinking about the nature of the task of managing these risks. With some small exceptions, such as Nick Bostrom's centre in Oxford, there isn't yet any kind of coherent science of studying and managing these risks. And I think that as a species, we've reached a point in our development where we need to develop that science to protect ourselves from our own success. And I think that that challenge of, in effect, designing a new practical science, that's a fascinating one from a perspective of a philosopher of science.
Everywhere.
Hugh Price, heading the Centre for the Study of Existential Risk at Cambridge. You're with the Philosopher's Zone, here on RN.
We really are talking about a system in which only a certain percentage of humanity would go. And that then brings up a lot of very interesting ethical questions that I think the people who are involved in existential risk are trying to avoid.
What's a risk for some might be an opportunity for others. Steve Fuller holds the chair at the University of Warwick, named after Auguste Comte, founder of positivism and sociology. You could say Comte was a stickler for order and progress. So it's fitting that one of Steve Fuller's projects is on something called Humanity 2.0, which presents a very different take to the robots rebelling. Steve Fuller, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. What does modern-day existential risk assume as you see it?
First of all, I think the important thing to keep in mind about existential risk is it's designed to imagine a kind of threat to all of humanity, the possibility of extinction, no less. And it's something that's also seen to be technologically driven. In other words, to be something like an unintended consequence of the trajectory that science and technology is already taking, but in a way that instead of empowering us actually has the potential for completely annihilating the species. And I do think that in a sense, this kind of setting up of the problem of existential risk is problematic in several ways.
Let me take the first of those two. It doesn't equally make it a risk for everybody.
That's right. I mean, I think if you look at the sorts of risks that we have, in fact, had to sort of undergo over the course of history, even the ones that have been unintentionally caused, typically not all of humanity is equally at risk. And in a way, you can sort of see this already in place because human beings actually live under many different circumstances. We normally talk about this in terms of social and political inequality. But what that means in practice, of course, is that people are living under radically different material conditions. And as it were, depending on the kind of risk we're talking about, different people will be affected differently by it. So, for example, if you had a kind of a supercomputer or a super intelligence, as it's sometimes called, that, let's say, short-circuited the entire internet and made it impossible to communicate by that means, it doesn't follow that everybody would actually be equally damaged by this. I mean, obviously, a large number of people, maybe even most of the population, would be very seriously damaged, but there are still quite a lot of people in the world, maybe not the sort of people in the world we're normally paying attention to, in other words, might not be people in the developed world, but people in what we would call the developing world, even at the very bottom end, might actually be able to survive perfectly well in a world in which the internet was completely obliterated.
Yet on first blush, I don't think people would draw that equivalence with, say, economic inequality or the internet going down. What is described is usually some kind of, well, as you say, super intelligent robot that loses its moorings, wants to meet its objectives, it tries to do it at an extraordinary rate and wipes out half of humanity doing it. That's the kind of example it's set up, isn't it?
Well, that's right. The interesting thing about setting up the example that way, it sets the problem up in such a way that it kind of detaches it a little bit from moral choice, I would say. Because typically these kinds of machines, the reason why they sort of go out of control is a kind of unintended consequence of the way we've programmed them. So in the sort of the kind of example that, let's say, Nick Bostrom, who is at the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford, who's very much promoting this idea of existential risk as something that should be on the top of the policy agenda, the kind of thing he imagines is a machine that is designed to collect paper clips, and it's been programmed to do that objective, but it's also been programmed in a very sophisticated way so it can actually learn better techniques for doing so. And so what he imagines is that through this kind of learning process. It may decide at some point that human beings are sort of, you know, surplus to requirements with regard to this objective, and as a result, sort of unintentionally, kind of almost casually, eliminate human beings because in some sense their existence gets in the way of actually getting to the last paper clips that need to be gotten. Now, you see, when you set up the problem this way, it ends up to be seen as a purely kind of engineering problem in a sense. Namely, you know, we've got to stop programming machines that are able to sort of, you know, find themselves in this kind of state down the road through some sort of self-learning process. But what it doesn't really get to is kind of the issue about, well, look, even if we did have such a machine, and even if it did do this kind of thing unintentionally, it's very unlikely that all of humanity would be subjected to this. And so there's a sense in which what this kind of problematic doesn't want to face is the idea that even in the most extreme cases, we really are talking about a system in which only a certain percentage of humanity would go. And that then brings up a lot of very interesting ethical questions about the sorts of lives that are worth preserving. And it gets us back to those more traditional kinds of ethical questions that I think the people who are involved in existential risk are trying to avoid.
So what are those questions?
So, for example, it seems quite clear that there's going to be a trade-off in some sense between the scaling up of technology so that it enables human beings, in a general sense, those who have the ability to get to that technology, to empower themselves more and to be able to do more things and to be able to make a certain kind of scientific and technological progress. But this will in itself bring in the kinds of risks that are associated with existential risk. But some of those people will actually be relatively immune to the consequences of those risks, even though they're the ones who are initiating it because they're wealthy people. They have ways of kind of taking shelter or compensating or whatever. But of course, there are going to be other people who will be, as it were, part of the collateral damage of this sort of advanced technology. And then the question becomes, what kind of responsibility do we have to those kinds of people? And it seems to me that posing the question that way brings us back, it seems to me, much more squarely into recognizable terrain about how do we actually have a just society where we recognize that there are existing inequalities where people are, in fact, differently affected by different kinds of things that take place, not only from the natural world, but from the innovations that we introduce in the name of progress.
Mm. So you're saying that in engineering it or making it into an engineering problem, the larger issues of living together as humans side by side are obliterated or occluded, put to the side.
That's right. Yes, I think it's a real big mistake to see this as some kind of a challenge of species extinction because it operates under the false assumption that we are already in it together. I don't actually think that human beings yet are sufficiently constituted and interconnected or sufficiently equal or equally identify with each other to actually be seen as a kind of coherent collective community that in some sense could be under threat.
Mm-hmm. The other area or the other undertow or theme of your critique is that of it being a sort of techno-pessimism and that in fact there is an optimistic side to this as well. And I know this marries in and links into your thoughts on transhumanism. Perhaps you could explain a little bit about that.
Right. So there is this kind of view that's been very much on the table, especially in Western philosophy, called humanism. And humanism is basically about privileging the value of the world on human existence and things that relate to the human condition. And that's normally called humanism. And, you know, people who don't like humanism call it anthropocentric, right? In the sense that there are other sources of value in the world that aren't human. But humanism has been a very strong strain, especially within Western philosophy. And from a practical standpoint, has been very much responsible for the idea of human rights, the idea that there's a dignity to the human being that goes above and beyond, you know, as it were, not torturing animals. We're more than just an animal in that sense, that there are other things that are required of us to live decent lives. So that's humanism. And then transhumanism comes on the scene because there's a sense in which the humanist project as we currently pursue it and understand it, I should say, of course, a lot of people don't believe in humanism. And so when it thinks about animal rights people, people concerned about rights of nature, rights of the environment, in a sense, those people are taking us away from humanism altogether. But transhumanism is actually saying that, in a sense, the humanist project on its own terms hasn't gone far enough. right? But now we got to move to the next level, and we got to take full advantage of all the science and technology that's available to enhance the human condition so that in some sense we can actually have, you know, absolute value dominance of the planet and who knows, maybe even the cosmos. So we're talking here about a range of projects that on the one hand have to do with life extension, but on the other hand, of course, there are people who are talking in terms of the human being, the biological nature of human beings, in some sense merging with technology, right? I mean, we've always been enhanced at a prosthetic level by things like eyeglasses, and of course people who are disabled have wheelchairs and crutches and all these other kinds of things. But the transhumanists also want to consider the possibility that we might merge with the machines in some substantial way. So, for example, a lot of the more science fictional talk about uploading consciousness, for example, if you recall the recent film that Johnny Depp starred in, Transcendence, right? This kind of thing is also very much a part of the transhumanist agenda. And if you go down this route of transhumanism, a couple of things are implicated with regard to the idea of existential risk. On the one hand, risk isn't necessarily seen as a bad thing. And I think this is one point that is very important with regard to transhumanism, because the people who are talking a lot about existential risk are basically talking about it from the standpoint of risk as a threat. And this goes very much against the transhumanist sensibility, which is basically about embracing risk as the way in which you can take advantage of opportunities.
So are you saying, just to get this clear, the engineering that leads us to perhaps the robot that might go AWOL, crazy, that same engineering could be actually taking us into another form of transhumanism and yes. would be valuable to us as opposed to us being cowering in a corner as whilst we're under
exactly.
attack?
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. That is the point, right? So the point here is that if you actually treat all of these new technologies, including the ones that would scale up the intelligence of machines to the kinds of levels that the existential risk people are worried about, we may come to actually identify with those machines as part of our humanity. This is, in a sense, part of what the transhumanist scenario is about. And so in terms of these sort of superintelligences, by the time they are likely to develop, there's a strong possibility that a large percentage of humanity will be identifying with the superintelligences in some way. If you want to think about how the social community, the social fabric would be formed in the future, we shouldn't assume that it's just going to be constituted by Homo sapiens, humanity 1.0 type beings. Okay? I mean, this kind of way of thinking in which, you know, you imagine that the human community actually extends outward from Homo sapiens is already kind of talked about quite a lot in terms of the animal rights community and the environmentalist community with regard to other animal species, right? That in a sense, that our life world isn't just constituted by humans, but it's constituted by all these other beings. And what I'm saying is that we should also think of these super intelligent machines as potentially part of that environment too, and that some human beings might, in fact, because of their interaction with these machines, identify more with those machines than with the more traditional forms of human beings. But in a sense, all that does is it kind of, you might say, brings to a kind of new level kind of traditional notions of what it means to live in a tolerant liberal society. So in other words, what you have to imagine with transhumanism is not that everybody's going to turn into this super intelligent machine, but rather you're going to have lots of different kind of hybrid interactions between biological and technological beings that are going to constitute the human life world. You know, we're going to have to imagine a space in which all those different kinds of entities can live harmoniously together.
It's hard enough as it is. Steve Fuller is from the University of Warwick on the upside of superintelligence.
Imagine a machine with a full range of human emotion. Its analytical power will be greater than the collective intelligence of every person in the history of the world. Some scientists refer to this as the singularity.
Professor?
I call it transcendence.
Transhumanism, Hollywood style, from the movie Steve Fuller mentioned. And before Steve Fuller, we heard from Hugh Price with a more cautious view. Thanks to the team this week, Diane Dean and Joe Wallace. I'm Joe Gelonesi. Hope to see you again next week in The Zone.